Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone to Harvard Geography Colloquium. This is the November edition. I'm Jeff Blossom. I'm with the Center for Geographic Analysis, and we do these colloquiums once a month. We also do something called ABC GIS presentations once a month. That's more sort of technically focused, but you get two of these every month, and look on our website, gis.harvard.edu, for upcoming events. Today, I'm delighted to have Andres Sevcuk with us. He's an assistant professor of urban planning at the Harvard Graduate School of Design. His most recent research focuses on developing new spatial network analytic tools for planners and designers. And he's doing a whole lot more that's on his bio. I'm not going to read through the entire bio because there's so much going on. I will mention a few prizes he's been awarded in the past: the President's Design Award in Singapore, the International Buckminster Fuller Prize, and the Ron Brown Fulbright Fellowship. Before Harvard, he was an assistant professor of architecture and planning at the Singapore University of Technology and Design and a lecturer at MIT. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff, for the kind invitation. It's a pleasure to be here and be part of the CGA that does amazing things at Harvard, and I'm very glad we have this institution. So what I will be talking about today is a somewhat fuzzy area between urban analytics and urban design. As most of you probably know, in professional practice, designers and analysts usually belong to rather different silos. When urban planners or urban designers work on projects, fairly frequently are certain aspects or renditions of this project sent out to an engineering or analytic team somewhere else, and 2 weeks later they come back with certain analytic results. And this creates a certain, first of all, a very slow feedback loop for project development and actual adjustments that might come from analytic results. And it also creates a sort of professional silo between the two fields. Now, urban analytics has recently emerged as a buzzword in many planning programs. And we actually just, this very academic year, end of summer, established a new urban analytics concentration in the Master of Urban Planning program. It exists in many other planning programs around the country. There's one at Columbia, one at MIT, UPenn. There's something like that at UCL London, in ETH Zurich, at Berkeley University, California, and so on. So part of what I tried to discuss and explore today is what urban analytics is, what types of urban design or planning problems it might help address. Second, how might it differ from the very well-established fields of geographic analysis that are already out there? And lastly, what might its impact be to the practice of urban planning and design if integrated in a meaningful way? So I'd like to start by arguing that there's been a series of historic movements that are analytic in nature and have come to affect planning or talk about planning issues in the past. Some of those are cybernetics that came about in the 50s and also in the 60s. Followed by perhaps system dynamics approaches by Forrester, who was at MIT. And those early movements in sort of computational problem analysis promised a pretty profound effect to planning. And in fact, they did affect a number of policy approaches. System dynamics in particular remains an important area of problem analysis. And then somewhere in the 80s, GIS was born and became mainstream because of personal computers being on the market in the 90s. And of course, as you know, it has taken on its life of its own since. So this new term, urban analytics, emerged fairly recently, post-2000, I would argue. The question is sort of how does it fit in, and how does it relate to some of these earlier fields? On the urban design and generally on the design side, there's been also a series of movements that have tried to integrate analytic processes to design. Probably one of the more famous ones of those has been Christopher Alexander's work, who was actually here at Harvard doing his PhD. And he produced a couple of very important books out of this work, Notes on the Synthesis of Form and Pattern Language, and in essence sort of produced this design methods approach that argued that if you rigorously enough define problems you're working on and apply a certain methodology on those problems, then solutions will almost automatically emerge based on that methodological approach to problems. So in some ways, this promised a direct connection between analysis and design. And it became actually criticized by a fair amount of people, and most notably perhaps the Cambridge School in the UK, where folks like Leslie Martin and Lionel March said that, hold on a sec, there's nothing automatic from moving from analysis to design. They argued that what Christopher Alexander had produced is an approach that allows people, or lets people know how to design, but not what to design. That there's a crucial step in between analysis and design where certain production has to occur. Ideas have to be applied to analytic results. And without that creative step, no design would automatically emerge from any analytics. So there was a series of papers and also book chapters produced in the Martin Center in the UK where design methods approach critically argued that we have to proactively integrate production and design into these analytic processes. On the urban designer side too, and in perhaps more sort of practice-oriented views, there's a clear sentiment amongst almost every urban designer that there is a relationship between what is being designed, the urban environments, the physical layouts and configurations of place, and their use. And this is perhaps well captured in this quote by the Smithsons, who were members of Team 10, who argue that they talk about this life between buildings, as perhaps Jungiel would call it, and they call it the charged void. And they say that the charged void describes architecture's capacity to charge the space around it with energy, which can join up with other energies, define the nature of things that might come, anticipate happenings. And they say that this is a capacity we can feel and act on as designers, but cannot necessarily describe or record. In other words, they argue that there is clearly a relationship between urban configuration and its use, but that may be elusive to any analytic method and can be sort of intuitively captured by designer, but not necessarily analyzed. And in this work, I try to argue that the design or the charged void can indeed be described and analyzed if we apply certain frameworks to it. And in order to do so, at least in my work, I have found it a very productive way to look at this is to focus simultaneously on paths and places in the environment, on the locations where activities originate from or where people travel to, and the infrastructure networks, whether it's pedestrian, bicycle, public transit, or car networks, etc. But that framework that represents at the same time the origins, destinations of human activity in cities and the infrastructure networks that bond them seems to be a productive way of exploring this idea of the charged void that Smithsons described. And this is increasingly, I also would argue, recognized in many planning areas, most notably perhaps in sort of the joint land use transportation planning, which inherently means that when we look at land uses and transportation, we look at their mutual interactions and we can oftentimes solve accessibility problems or urban connectivity issues by either tweaking land uses or transportation, not necessarily one silo or the other. So in this broader world of effects that urban design can have on the use of space, I sort of narrow my work generally to two interrelated questions, which are much narrower than what planners might ask across the board. But these two questions usually have to do with how urban design affects access to opportunities in urban environments. And second, how urban design affects the use of streets and public space in urban environments. And to me, these have been important questions that affect us all and have a role in shaping some of the most important characteristics of urban environments that we all sense and feel when we use streets and public spaces. And also they address or affect issues of equity and efficiency that cities ought to be producing. One of the sort of underlying reasons why we live in cities is arguably that they facilitate access in ways that perhaps less dense environments and country living don't. So towards this end, what we have been producing in the City Forum Lab are a couple of software plugins that bring some analytic tools to bear on this framework and allow urban designers and planners to apply analytics to the designs they're working on. And I'll mention a few of these tools. This is a part of the Urban Network Analysis Toolbox for Rhino. It's a plugin for Rhino, which is a very popular design software amongst architects and urban designers and physical planners. The goal here has been to produce some analytic tools that are rather powerful and cutting edge in many respects, but put them in an environment that a designer can use within a few clicks without sort of having to rely on this time lag by doing a design and handing it off to an analyst and then getting it back a few weeks later. So very much interested in reducing this time lag so that the analysis can start informing the design. It makes it really easy as a platform to also change and modify the environments that we're analyzing within a few clicks, et cetera. So a couple of examples of the analytics or metrics that it produces. So on the first, there's a series of different accessibility metrics, and I'll mention just two of those here. First is what's oftentimes called in the literature a cumulative opportunities type index. We call it the REACH index. Is a network-based accessibility index that simply counts how many opportunities of any type you specify can you access within a given travel range, whether it's in a 10-minute a bike range or walk range within the built environment around you. And so if there's more opportunities that you can reach within a given walk shed or travel shed, then the index goes up, and if there's less, it goes down. And a simple example of computing it would be to take a place like Darwin's Coffee Shop in West Cambridge and ask how many households can get to Darwin's within a 10-minute walk from the surrounding urban environment. So it simply enumerates how many destinations are around. And of course, it could be applied to any type of destination. So we can analyze access to transit stops, access to businesses, jobs, residents with this simple accessibility index. And here's just one example of applying it at a fairly large scale. This is at the national scale. We recently completed some analysis of access to retail clusters in the United States across all cities. And this chart here describes the percent of population that lives within 1 kilometer, which we consider to be a 15-minute walk, from a retail cluster of at least 25 stores. So this is sort of the types of clusters that we are very familiar with in Cambridge, like the Inman Squares, this even Ball Squares in Somerville, or the larger clusters like Central Harvard, etc. So we first clustered all businesses in North America and then analyzed the, from census block levels how many people lived within a 10-minute walk from them. And it ranges from around 88% across New York City. By the way, if we just applied Manhattan alone, it would be 100%. All the way down to Fort Worth, Memphis, Detroit, where it's about 5, 6, 4% of the population. And so it's still using a very simple index. This is cumulative opportunities, and this just counts how many people are around, and then we convert that number of people into percentage of the total in the city. But it opens up a series of interesting questions about what cities can do in order to increase that access. And what we also found is that the United States, across the entire population, about 7% of people live within a 10-minute walk from a transit station. And transit here means excludes buses, so it means light or heavy rail transit, which is something that the Department of Transportation shares as their data set. It's about 7% of the United States population lives within a 10-minute walk from those transit stops, whereas about 15% in total lives around a retail cluster. So that's kind of brought about this idea of arguing for amenity-oriented development in environments where you don't have transit or there's no hope for transit in any foreseeable future, to say that by incentivizing developments to be close to amenities, we can cut down on carbon emissions and a lot of trips that otherwise would require a car. And that usually, so in this chart, actually, we list the cities that have the highest percentage of population near amenity clusters, and below is the lowest share of population. So this lowest ranges from 4 to 9%, and the highest ranges from 40 to 88%. And obviously, there's certain built environment characteristics that are correlated with this. For instance, all of the cities in the top tier are much denser in terms of residential density, in terms of FAR, which is the floor area ratio, as well as built coverage. So by incentivizing density of different types, population density, built density, et cetera, it has a sort of a tangential or related effect on achieving environments where you have retail provisions close by and people do not necessarily have to rely on mechanized modes of transport for getting to them. So this is a bit of a kind of an example of applying the reach index or the cumulative opportunities accessibility index. And more well-known, I guess, also a bit more nuanced but robust accessibility index is called the gravity index, proposed by Hansen in the 1950s, who I believe was actually Kevin Lynch's master student. Stephen might know. But he published a paper after he left MIT, and the gravity index has become the workhorse of accessibility studies, I think, across sectors, especially in transportation. So what it does differently from the reach index is it also takes into account how much transportation costs you spend in getting to the destinations. It doesn't simply count what you can access in a, let's say, 10-minute walk shed, but also discounts the destinations by the travel cost of getting there. So that's what's in the denominator of the index, is the exponential function of distance. And therefore, a destination that's right next to us counts more heavily than a destination that's on the edge of the walk shed that we're walking to. And this is in Berkeley also clear, that we our sort of likelihood to go to destinations in cities drops with distance, and it drops in an exponential way. This is a TRB study that shows percent of transit users who walk to transit stops in several cities, and the exponential decay rate basically describes that as distance on the x-axis gets longer, the likelihood of people walking there drops exponentially. And there's some differences among cities. So for instance, climate tends to play an important role. In colder places, people might walk less, or in cities that have a walking culture, people might walk more, et cetera, et cetera. And there's also an income difference. So wealthy folks tend to walk less than lower income folks. But it's possible to empirically define this decay rate in different cities by conducting a small survey or looking at the city's official travel surveys that are published, and then applying this decay rate in the index to describe accessibility. So for instance, these couple of examples here describe access from individual buildings to, in this case, transit stations around Cambridge and a little bit of Boston, and they weigh the transit stations by their importance. So subways are treated as five times more important than bus stops, but having two bus stops starts compensating one subway stop, and so on. And we start developing this sort of picture of accessibility across transit modes from every individual buildings and measured along the network. And if we change the type of destination, then, for instance, we can measure access to jobs from every individual building. And And the hotspots then become the MGH area in Boston and also the MIT surroundings, which have about 50,000 jobs per square mile right around Kendall. But what I want to emphasize across these examples is that in accessibility indices, if we measure these things, the interesting question is, how can we change the outcome of the index? What are the key factors that shape the outcome of the index? And there's, in fact, four different factors underlying this, which are all actionable in urban planning and design that we could adjust in order to change an index. So first, if transportation or the sort of impedance of coming from origins and going to destinations gets easier or cheaper, then our accessibility grows. So this is oftentimes what city transport departments try to do in order to improve accessibility is to implement transit systems, to add a new bus line or a new subway line. And because how sort of traditionally the sectors of planning and transportation are a little bit siloed, oftentimes accessibility issues are foremost solved with transportation solutions like this one. But we should also remember that the exact same index can be increased or changed equally by increasing the density of destinations around the location without touching transportation whatsoever. And the index would equally increase if we had more destinations around locations. So this is a kind of a development or land use policy approach to changing accessibility in a city. It would also go up or change if we change the capacity of the destination. So keeping the number of destinations constant, if we, for instance, talk about access to hospitals or schools or access to retailers, then the capacity also directly affects the outcome too. Having more floor space or capacity to existing destinations will change the outcome, keeping everything else constant. And finally, the spatial connectivity of the environment also plays a role. So we should remember that where a location that we, an amenity or point of interest that we're discussing is located with respect to the sort of street network plays a big role. So for instance, corner properties typically have much better access than sort of mid-block properties to local amenities. We've looked at it in Cambridge and there's about a 50% difference. So for instance, if we look at residential areas of Cambridge and analyze access to shops, then if a shop is located in a mid-block environment, they typically access within the same walk shed something like 50% less patrons than they do at a corner location. So in low-density environments, this can play a fairly significant role of where we place facilities without having to change anything about the transportation system or the density of them. So the second set of indices that I just wanted to briefly introduce before going to example applications that the Urban Network Analysis Toolbox usually operates with are pedestrian flow estimates, which help us analyze, with given a certain configuration of urban form and transportation networks, how will that configuration produce movement on city streets and in public spaces at different times of the day? And this is usually computed with what are called betweenness type of accessibility indices. It comes from actually graph theory or network studies. And it's a fairly simple index that was originally meant to describe how important people or nodes are in social networks. So for instance, if you look at Facebook connections and apply the traditional betweenness metric to that, then the metric would create a connection from every Facebook user to every other Facebook user, and then measure how many times these connections pass other users along the way, and those that are most central to the network that are crossed by most connections have the highest betweenness value. When we apply this to space, then the geometry really matters, so the network becomes the street graph or the street network, and we need to do a few other adjustments to the index. But here's a very simple example of only one origin and one destination. So traditionally, the betweenness metric uses shortest paths. This comes from the social network analysis. And if we use the same framework here, then I'm routing, in this example, 100 students from the main entrance of MIT along the shortest path to the Graduate School of Design. And you see the betweenness values of every segment along the way are 100, because it's every segment is passed by the same 100 students. Now, in spatial networks, we don't necessarily know the shortest paths or even care to use them. Oftentimes we go with slightly longer paths or just more pleasant paths. And what pedestrian analysis and empirical work has found is that commonly people deviate around 15 to 20% over the shortest path, not necessarily walking the shortest path. So we've introduced a detour factor in this tool, which you can key in, and then it finds the sort of probability distribution from the same origin to the same destination. You still have a 100 people starting and 100 people reaching the GSD, but the probability distribution over the network is different. And there are certain routes that are more probable than others simply because many more of the paths that are generated happen to overlap at these. So for instance, Mass Avenue still comes out as very highly probable, even though it doesn't. We don't assume that everybody goes down this route. And a kind of a related application of this tool, and I'll show this can be applied to hundreds or even thousands of origins and destinations to model movement in urban environments. But a related application of this tool is to also sometimes distribute our assumption of where people come from when we analyze access to facilities. So when we talk about access in cities, most transportation work would assume that we start our trips from fixed locations like home or workplaces. But when you think about the amenities that you visit on a daily basis in cities, whether they're for running errands or visiting shops or visiting food places, oftentimes we actually patronize such places on the way somewhere else, not necessarily from our home. And that means for planning also, it doesn't always make sense to place supermarkets so that they're close to people's homes. If they happen to, for instance, use transit systems on a daily basis, it might be more convenient to pick something up right outside of the transit stop on the way home, and that could increase access to amenities. So a similar index, like the betweenness one I just showed, is used to distribute weights. So for instance, if we have an origin building of 100 people here and an amenity of interest, and then if these people use a certain daily destination, like this could be a transit stop or something like that, then under a very simple assumption, we could it might look like originally that the amenity is pretty far from the place, but if they walk this route every day, then they actually go right past it on a daily basis. And we can apply the same probability distribution on the network to kind of say that we don't know exactly what route these people might walk to this destination, but there's a certain distribution that might go nearer or further from that amenity. But essentially what this distribution does is that it now, instead of having one point with an attribute weight of 100 at the origin, we have hundreds or even thousands of points. Each one takes a fraction of the original weight value, and the sum of weights across all these points equals the same 100. So there's no more a weight of 100 here, but we've distributed the origin point weight across the network. And now when we do this from hundreds of origin points, we get a kind of approximation or our best guess picture of how people might be distributed during the morning or evening commute when going to work or coming home from work in the neighborhood. And then locating amenities takes a different meaning with respect to accessing those people, if we no longer assume they come for homes. So just to make a concrete example of what that might mean, I'll show two example applications. The first one is a project that we did as a lab with a Singapore Housing Development Board. It's the public housing authority of Singapore, and they house around 83% of the island state's population. And because they're so big and they manage over 1 million housing units, they also have to plan commercial centers for people. So they do retail clusters and food courts and a significant amount of that actually. And typically the HDB plans its retail environments or commercial environments in three categories: town centers, neighborhood centers, and precinct centers. And so this example shows one of their towns, which is called Punggol New Town, which has about 100,000 dwelling units. It will have about 300,000 people when complete. And the HDB is sort of in the process of planning facilities for that. These black dots here show the retail centers that have already been built out with square meters of net leasable area marked on them. And then these gray dots are the locations of high-rise dwelling units. So these are multi-story apartment buildings, and the H dot represents the entrance to an apartment block of those sorts. So to use the framework I just described to help us plan where to put retail facilities, we can look at this through this sort of lens of distribution of the weights or the betweenness tool I described. So if we, this is the existing or sort of projected built out distribution density of households. Every dot is a, let's say a staircase to a high rise dwelling unit. And so the warmer colors are mean more units and cooler colors less units. And we know in this context in Singapore that 85% of the population uses public transit to get to work every day. So there's a huge mode share in public transit. So we know that they walk from homes to transit stops, and we developed a model to analyze probabilistically where those walks would lead. And there's actually three types of destinations. There's bus, light rail, and metro stops, only one metro stops, and then the green dots are light rail stops. And we then applied a certain probability matrix that, for instance, if you have a metro stop within 400 meters from your house, then chances are you're gonna use that to get to work. But if you don't have any metro nearby your house, then we split the probability between light rail versus bus. And if you only have a bus stop, then that's probably your only option. So there were lots of if-then kind of possibilities in this. And that produced a projected footfall estimation across the entire town during the morning or evening peak when people go from homes to transit stops or back from transit stops to homes. Now, the sum of weights of these distributed points is exactly the same as the original households. We still have 100,000 households, but now we've just taken them from homes and spread them across the street network to model what it might look like during the evening peak hour. And then using these as our new inputs, we apply what is the Huff retail patronage model. I'm not sure whether it's a familiar concept, but in retail planning, it's a very well-known and widely used model for estimating how many people will patronize what destination. So the Huff model basically says that the probability of anyone, any resident from an origin point, to go to a particular shopping destination depends on the accessibility to that particular center and the sum of accessibilities to all centers that are around them. And so it's a ratio always between 0 and 1. So if the accessibility to a particular center is really high, then the probability also going there becomes much higher. And we modified the Huff model and implemented it in the UNA toolbox on the networks, in fact, introducing a new term in the model. So the traditional Huff patronage model actually assumes that all of the people will end up at destinations. So all of the demand always gets cleared. So if you have 100,000 people in town, the Huff model will apply probabilities, but it will allocate all of the 100,000 people somewhere. And we discovered when conducting surveys in this area that and other HDB towns in Singapore too, that in fact, the likelihood of going to a destination, just like the example of bus stops earlier, also depends on access to the destination. So if you have less retail access, you go less frequently. And we saw that as a pretty robust correlation, and then introduced this new distance decay term to the model, which takes care of the effect that households who really don't have a lot of destinations around will also be modeled as going there less frequently. Now, taking this as the model, what happens if we, these are the existing retail centers that are already built out, and the numbers here indicate the estimated number of visits if we assume that the visits come from home locations, from dwelling units. Now, and that resulted in 33,000 visits. And if we then change our assumption simply using these distributed weights that I mentioned, and now it's the same households, but we've put their demand weight from homes to rather the streets during the peak hour in the evening, let's say, then by just changing the assumption where we think people come from, the patronage can already go up. So in this instance, it comes to about 35,000 visits by simply having changed the assumption where origins are. And so that's an important point, actually, in the study, that the change in origin points also affects where how much we estimate a certain type of facility to be used. Now, we then took the same approach and said, let's look at the future build-out scenarios for this town. These are just existing retail centers, but let's look at what HDB intends to do in the next 10, 15 years when building out this town. And we noticed, for instance, that if the HDB, this is the sort of a status quo plan, what was already available by the HDB, if the centers are built out that way, then the overall patronage across all destinations was around 38,000. But however, if we adjusted the destinations that are not yet built and put the destinations closer to these key walk routes that lead to transit stops that people use on a daily basis, we would expect a higher patronage of all combined. And this is simply because we improve accessibility to the centers. We move them closer to where people already walk. And to do this, there was actually two adjustments. One was moving the locations of the centers, but then an equally interesting spatial analysis problem was adjusting how big the centers are, because HDB traditionally uses these town, neighborhood, and precinct sizes, which are kind of typical sizes that were noted in the slide earlier. And we then also asked, well, since accessibility doesn't just depend on how far a destination is, but also how attractive it is, how would we go about deciding how big the center should be? Should it still use the same hierarchy of one large town center, some neighborhood centers, and then lots of little precinct centers? Or should some category be more emphasized than another? Should we maybe have one huge town center and no neighborhood centers whatsoever? Or should we only have neighborhood centers and so on and so on? So that was analytically very, very hard to do because it results in just an intractable number of combinatorics. If we try to at the same time solve locations and sizes, and there's like millions of location options, plus millions of size options. But what we instead did is that we fixed the location pattern at the optimal locations that were close to the walk routes on day-to-day transit visits. And then with these fixed locations, we built a simulation tool in the Urban Network Analysis Toolbox that would iterate through every possible size combination. And so what happens in this graph is in this the x-axis here shows the percent of all space that's meant for this town being concentrated in the town center. So at zero, it means that there's no town center, and then all of the space is split between neighborhood and precinct centers. And at 100, it means that we only have one town center and no neighborhood centers whatsoever, or precinct centers. And within each hump, the graph moves from, for instance, in this case, it means that 100% is at the precinct centers, and as the graph moves up, a greater allocation goes to neighborhood centers, and then in the next step, we have like 5%. This is done at 5% intervals, so we have 5% steps here. So basically, what we learned from this simulation was that, in fact, if HDB uses the same hierarchy, then we, with precinct centers being very important, or if we split the amount of space between precinct centers and neighborhood centers, then we would reach patronage somewhere in the middle of the graph like this. But what it showed to us was that, in fact, if we built larger neighborhood centers and had no precinct centers, which are usually about 3 to 5 stores large, whereas neighborhood centers are somewhere between a dozen and 20 stores large, then the estimated patronage to the destinations would be greatest. So basically, comparing across scenarios, we found that by optimizing location and size, we could get the estimated patronage up by around 10% total. And this also led to kind of a typology suggestion that instead of planning these sort of large shopping center type destinations, if we now sort of reconceptualize how retail destinations are distributed in the city or in these HDB towns, then it might lead to rather sort of a linear or street-oriented commerce that is spread along walk routes that are used anyways across the day, accessing jobs. And if you look at the sort of present distribution of retail space across all HDB towns in Singapore, then in fact, the largest amount, the largest percentage share, which is close to half of all floor space in these retail environments, is given to these tiny little precinct centers, which have 3 to 5 stores each. And this is actually a political move. It's something that HDB does to please residents, to say, you know, everyone has a store within 400 meters from your house. And what we found as part of this study and made a recommendation to HDB is that this, while it makes political sense perhaps to do it, your town-wide retail patronage would probably be more robust if you had fewer of these tiny ones and more of these mid-scale centers that have a dozen to 20 stores. So this goes against some of the practice they've engaged in now. And then just to run through a quick second example, which is much shorter, I want to show another application of these tools to urban design problems and then summarize. So this is a work that we did together with the World Bank in Surabaya, Indonesia, which is second largest town in Indonesia. And the city had commissioned a study for a light rail system. This is this orange line, is this planned light rail corridor that runs through the city center. So that alignment had already been fixed and the stations had already been designated. And we were asked to look at the transit-oriented development agenda around this line. So what could we do through urban design and planning and zoning to make sure that the development supports ridership on this tram? So this is just one example of a much bigger study, but it's a good sort of spatial analysis example. We started by looking at population densities around the light rail corridor. And this is basically the equivalent of census blocks in Indonesia. And then try to analyze how people would access these stops in the future once the line is actually built. And to do that, we use the same betweenness tool as I mentioned earlier. So from every census block, or these are actually even smaller than the US census blocks, sometimes there are only 10 to 20 households in a block here. We analyzed what is the most likely walk routes or distribution of walk routes that lead to their nearest tram stop. And then did it from all of the couple of thousand census blocks that were around. And by doing that, we basically detected the most likely key connectors that would lead from homes to transit stations. And this led to a sort of gigantic problem of trying to upgrade or retrofit 269 kilometers of streets, which is way out of scale of what the city would be capable of doing. So instead, we filtered out the most critical or most traffic paths out of this, those that had a footfall density over 5,000 people per day, and said that this is the sort of most critical routes. And then for this set of routes, proposed an upgrading program to the city that involved improving pavement, drainage, landscaping, bike lanes, lighting, etc. And just for context, when we talk about streets, especially in the environment of kampungs, which are informal urban villages in Indonesia, then as many streets don't have sidewalks whatsoever. Whenever it rains, they flood entirely, and access to transit would be entirely compromised in many of the current streets. So the idea was to just make sure that the key routes are accessible and moderately comfortable for getting in. And these this work also led us to think that when we do these estimates of pedestrian densities that we project in a future scenario on streets, then it would be also important to put a face on the number. So if we have a prediction of something like 4,000 pedestrians per day or maybe 200 per hour, so what does it really mean for the city to give some face to it? And we produced this thing called the street catalog, where we've been sort of shooting time-lapse videos on various streets around the world and recording the pedestrian density per hour on those streets and then putting some extra accessibility metrics on the side. But just to give you an example, this is by Brattle Square in right here at Harvard. This density that we see, this is 12 times normal speed, is usually the time-lapse speed we've been using, corresponds to 904 people per hour on average. So it's just a catalog of examples that is meant to really describe what the numbers mean to the policymaker who might be working on doing a street upgrade or proposal. Just to come towards a conclusion, doing this work has also highlighted that we have oftentimes data needs that cities don't necessarily have. A recent article from a street blogger in Denver says that, and they're talking about sidewalk improvements and zero vision for the city, say that we can't really work on zero vision if we and eliminate traffic deaths if we don't have the data for it. So the city can't improve its walking network if it doesn't know where the weaknesses are, and yet no city department has an inventory of the city's sidewalks and crosswalks. And in some instances, when we operate in the context of Indonesia or even Singapore, we've had to survey the network ourselves. typically what cities do have in a complex urban environment is the street graph, which is probably surveyed by NAFTEC or somebody like NAFTEC. So there's street segments and nodes for the traffic lanes. But for these sorts of studies, we actually usually need instead the this street graph, which is the sidewalk network and the different connections. So for instance, many cities are now also working on step-free access programs for transportation on buses and on subways. But what does step mean? Step-free access really mean if the walk to the train is full of steps? And does it really help? So having this sort of data seems critical. I actually just got back from an interesting meeting at OECD yesterday in Paris, and there might be a working group starting to kind of develop standards for cities around the world on sidewalk data, which seems like an interesting approach. Furthermore, not just having network data, what might be a promising approach, one of the pilot projects we started at the City Forum Lab this summer was to see if we can utilize computer vision to also measure what happens on these sidewalks. So using feature detection to detect not perhaps just pedestrians, but also types of activities pedestrians are engaged in, whether they're in groups or alone, whether they're running or pushing a pram, and then also cyclist trucks and other things. And this seems like a promising approach that there are some private companies already doing it. And if it could be scaled up as a web service, then cities could possibly stream their own video feed through some sort of central service, and then in return get results tied to the network segments saying like what's happening on those segments over time. So with that, I would just like to conclude that just to sort of generalize the kind of relationship between urban analytics and design, that we all know that there's a whole suite of urban design problems where we actually don't need a computer or much analytics, and we do it best by just looking at the problems with our eyes and with a pen and paper and solving solutions on the fly. But there are also a set of problems that require a lot of tedious, repetitive trial and error or testing to be solved in urban design. And I would argue that it's precisely these types of combinatoric problems that are best solved by applying spatial analysis to them. And in order to do that, we oftentimes also need some sort of a key performance metric that we're trying to move towards. And so both of these examples had a very clear performance metric. So in the instance of Singapore's retail study, the performance metric was to maximize projected or estimated visits to the retail centers. And that's what we were trying to do, because it would both benefit the users who would have better access and the stores who would get more visits. And it was sort of a win-win situation. In the case of the Surabaya study, the idea was to detect streets that would be most utilized and then do an upgrade program on these streets. So these were well-defined performance criteria. And there are a set of problems where we don't get to define a performance. We don't even get to describe what the problem is very very carefully. So those problems would make it very difficult to apply spatial analytics to them in a design approach. And I also would like to argue that for urban analytics, especially if it's sort of something that's applied to projective design work, it's very important that the analysts not work only retrospectively analyzing existing conditions or existing scenarios, but instead that we bring the power of the analytics into the design process, and every step of the design process, we analyze these different solutions or scenarios that we're proposing and get to therefore shape the designs and really apply the analytics onto projective scenarios rather than existing scenarios. And I'd like to argue that that's one of maybe the defining characteristics or particularities of urban analytics as maybe separate from a traditional geographic analysis, which most often works with existing data sets that cities also share in open data services and so on. So bringing the analytics to synthetic design world, I think, is a promising and interesting approach for analytics in urban analytics. And what it means for curricula and development, I think, is interesting that if we then take this approach and say, if urban analytics really has to be projective too, not just retrospective, then it probably means that we need to train urban analysts not as just data analysts who know Python and some statistics and maybe some other methods, but also make sure that the same training involves problem solutions or problem solving in practice. So the studio type of environment or the applied project type of environment where we need to take the analytics and actually solve real world planning issues at the same time. And so this kind of maybe blurs the border between the analysts and the designers and makes that process more whole. So I'd like to kind of think that maybe we can, the GSD is a great place to try that approach to analytics, where we are not just data scientists, but we are data scientists who work on very applied spatial problems and bring those tools to the studio environment or the workshop environment. So let me just finish with that and we can have perhaps a few questions. Thank you.
So it's 1 o'clock. I understand that people need to leave. That's fine, but we have this room till 1:30. So let's do some questions.
Hey, following the rules. So I'm Daniel, a student at Urban Planning. So I have a few questions. Let me just stick to two. One, so you start at the beginning with saying that the old model is that an analyst would have taken the data, taken a week or two, and then come back with it. So the first question is, how long does this new kind of approach take, and is there a benefit to it? And the other one is in its applicability in cities, municipalities, where the data isn't as robust as what we were just talking about at the end. What does someone with an urban analytics background do in that situation, or what is someone looking with that data, trying to visualize it or make it into like actual plans, do if there's a lack of data?
Mm-hmm. Great, thanks. So most of the accessibility or pedestrian flow analysis or even the sort of patronage estimation takes a couple of clicks in Rhino in this moment. So it's really something that we can do over and over very easily in Rhino, and we can modify designs and it really takes seconds. If it's a small enough area, if we do a citywide analysis, it could take minutes to run a complex analysis, but it's certainly a lot slower or a lot faster than sending it off to somebody with a different platform. In terms of data, that's a very practical and real-world issue. We go to, especially the work in Indonesia. Jeff has been somewhat involved with it as well, and there's not a whole lot of data. There's two kind of approaches that work in the long run and the short run. In the short run, in some of the developing world settings, it's actually not so prohibitively expensive to survey data. So people going out and mapping things is feasible, and the apps make it a lot easier these days with GPS to map things. But in the longer run, it's important that cities develop capacity to have robust, at least minimum level data, and what we call it like a base map. And a base map in Cambridge is extremely powerful, and as Jeff has been doing a great job hosting this amazing data set and the city of Cambridge, in the context of Indonesia, we said there's five layers of data that maybe are the bare minimum that the cities would try to maintain. And some of those can actually be obtained fairly easily from a flyover, and some cannot so easily. So things that you can see from an airplane can be measured almost automatically, and others cannot. So we said they should host a database of building footprints, some topography, whether it's LiDAR scanned or points or at any interval, but it's in this context very often for drainage and flow analysis. Topography is absolutely critical. I mentioned building footprints, street center lines, topography, land uses, and finally the cadastral database, so the property lines. And lots of cities around the world don't host or have cadastral databases, and therefore also don't get to charge proper taxes and really short themselves in their fiscal budget. But some of those things, like building footprints and road center lines, we can see from space, and they can semi-automatically be detected, but land uses or property lines are not visible. And so they still require a lot of on-ground surveys.
Okay. Thank you.
Hmm. Yeah, maybe this and then Ramos.
So in both of the examples that you gave, there were certain sort of pretty fundamentally fixed elements of the design, whether it was the street grid in Singapore or the tramway line in Indonesia. And I'm wondering about, especially given how you started off your talk, about this sort of distinction between design and analysis, mm-hmm. How what you're talking about can be a generator of design, sort of earlier in the design process, and how that would have looked differently in either Singapore or Indonesia, whether the with your data the line of that tramway would have shifted significantly, mm-hmm. or whether the street grid would it become a radial plan, for example, or
So this is a great point, and it's something that we think about a lot. The Singapore example actually had a little element of design there. In fact, we didn't simply kind of look at an existing pattern and measure it, but we reallocated the centers. And this the part of design there was really just changing the pattern of retail destinations in the city and then adjusting their sizes. Versus in the Surabaya example, everything existed. We just detected what are most critical lanes and so on. There is, it's, I still believe that it's quasi impossible to derive from the analytics what the best design solution is. The best we have so far is some sort of fairly dumb iterative simulation approach where we, if we can define some changing rules, then we can simulate through lots of different environments and every time apply the same performance metric to them. And for instance, we could design an algorithm to then change street patterns in X ways and then run through 10,000 of them and then see which street pattern would perform the best. But the rules for changing that street pattern doesn't do not come from the analytics. A human intervention is needed there. The human sort of production or design is a critical approach to doing those. You might be aware of City Engine and Esri bot software now, and it's a procedural urban model that we write some shape rules and then it generates environments based on those shape rules. There too, the shape rules are entirely human determined. No analytics tells us what rules to code. But I do think that down the line, it would be an incredibly powerful approach to combine the procedural shape grammar approach with analytics. So right now, these are actually two separate worlds in the Esri products. The GIS tools cannot actually even read the shape output that comes from City Engine right now. It has to be sort of frozen and then translated into shape files to be analyzed. But if we could do it on the fly, then every single output we generate could be analyzed. And we could iterate through lots of different complex spatial problems and look for, essentially it's a search problem. We search through a certain universe of solutions, what performs better or worse according to our defined criterion. But again, the analytics so far really don't design. They analyze solutions that somebody has to design.
You just mentioned the benefits of combining this shape grammar with this spatial analytics, particularly for the case of pedestrians, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you also mentioned the feedbacks and relative or impact of the public transportation systems in the position and localization in terms of potential like access to commerce and other activities. But did you consider for further research or development or design combining these more pedestrian-focused tools with more urban transportation planning tools?
Yeah.
For example, like Cube or Transcat that can model and can support decision-making for tramways or
underground. And I mean, very often for public transit studies, you have to actually combine those two. I haven't personally done a whole lot of work in sort of public transit network planning or optimization. Most of this is at the last mile level between destinations and transit or just destinations that are in walking and biking reach with each other. But absolutely, I think TfL in London is doing a lot of great work in trying to combine transit accessibility and travel time indices with also the last mile into the same picture. And there's a lot to be done there. So you can actually even manage transportation problems by without having to do anything with buses and subways by just configuring things at the tail end of it in neighborhood level. It's an interesting question in lots of cities that, for instance, transport and housing are totally different departments and different budgets. But you can actually solve a transport problem with housing. So if you could have a fund where you could say, our goal is to increase accessibility to jobs or whatnot, then whether we achieve it better by investing into transport or into housing is irrelevant, whichever tool gets us better to the result. and blurring some of the physical boundaries between the city budget would be super interesting in as a kind of area for this. So I'm aware and interested in it. I just haven't done much work at the sort of transit network level myself.
Have you had a chance to sort of ground truth any of your predictions? So you might use a combination of gravity and gravity, Hof, and
reach
between us. Mm-hmm. That's right. And you might predict a given sort of change based on a particular infrastructural change. Then have you had situations where you could then sort of see whether what you thought was going to happen happened, mm-hmm. and maybe tweak your model or tweak your infrastructure?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we certainly have tried to do that and done it in both contexts of Cambridge and Singapore. The approach usually is we rarely get to see like a full before and after build out scenario comparison, but and maybe a simpler approach to calibration is to take an environment that exists. And for instance, in the case of the Hof model or the between, so the Hof model would predict visits to facilities, or between us would predict the number of people on streets. Then you could sort of calibrate a model, make a prediction, and then go and observe what's actually going on. And that's exactly what we've done in both Singapore and Cambridge. And that seems, I mean, that it's pretty robust. We can take a very good guess on pedestrian density, especially during peak hours. In some experiments with students in class have been in the range of 70% to 90% R squares for pedestrian density, for instance. And with shop visits in Singapore, it was something similar. But what's the real impediment is that it's really, really labor intensive to collect the data. And so for especially pedestrian flow modeling, I have hopes for this computer vision approach, that if we have camera feeds around the city and they would just collect pedestrian activity data on a routine basis, we'd have an enormous calibration data set, and we could then calibrate the model based on those. And then in that city, if any developer is doing a district plan or a development in a neighborhood, we can, based on those calibrations, estimate how that development will affect activity patterns on streets at different hours of the day, how many people it would generate, and so on. And that would be extremely interesting, I think, a direction for research. But doing those calibrations by surveying ground data visually is really, really labor intensive.
Extremely interesting. Thank you for the talk. the problem you could see from the side of the big city where you have huge concentrations of infrastructure capital flows of pedestrians and the need to construct information from the government in order to manage this urban renewal processes or new urban projects. But we have this other side where you have settlements that are lower density and intensity that are spread around huge territories and that actually need this information also. And from that perspective, do you foresee in the future, given that you can or you could solve some remote sensing or on-site survey challenges, do you see the collapse of the urban planner and the urban designer and the consultant into a single entity that actually senses, carries out analytical procedures and then designs and implements in a single, let's say, entity or a streamlined process?
Interesting. I think that the sensing and the analytics could naturally combine. So for instance, if you had a very good feature detection system for instance, flyover data, for high resolution flyover data, if you detect road networks, building footprints and heights, and maybe even take a guess of their land use based on certain form characteristics, you could just a question of chaining operations together, but you could then almost instantaneously apply analytics to that on the fly. But I remain of the opinion that design is far from being automatable. And at best, we can just produce legible and clear analytics and hand it to a designer who could then decide what to do based on that rather than automate the process. Because that would be very suspicious, actually, of an automated design result, because we know that most design problems that have any freedom degrees of freedom have millions of possible solutions. There's never one solution that satisfies the constraints, and that one solution generated by a computer would most likely mean that it's an arbitrary one.
Yeah.
And so that part, I think, would need to be human intervened.
Definitely, but having the information in that workflow, in that design workflow, but not automation,
mm-hmm.
That's the collapse that I was trying to understand.
Now
you have very robust teams with different types of consultants and with different types of analysts that actually create information, convey it into an entity that actually designed, making the entity a human team, and then implement.
Yeah.
Would that be collapsing to a single...
I think maybe the closest to where that might be really happening is some sort of an army operation. DARPA and other organizations, they do try to do a sort of live, if they operate with drone vision in remote cities around the world, they do feature detection and analytics and then immediately take decisions on how to route things and change things on the fly. And that may be the scenario. In most urban planning scenarios, such speed is perhaps even not needed, unless we're dealing with an instantaneous disaster situation. Maybe that's where your interests also are, but in most instances, it's better to maybe just generate the data analytics and then carefully think them through before I take a decision, rather than squeeze the time into as short as possible. There's Jeff and then Justin. Yeah.
So, I put together the data for the city, and I'm trying to think of, like, what would be the next level dream data set for you? We like sidewalk center lines with some kind of amenities, or we tried to get a crack at sidewalk center lines and pedestrian paths before from a flyover. We never really got there.
Right.
And but
the couple of
things by data.
a couple of things that would be I think really nice sidewalk center lines with all official crossings and lights and. Would be a great place to start. But then there's some data standard issues to be ironed out. So for instance, how do we draw open public spaces like the Science Center Plaza at Harvard or some other like downtown Boston, like City Hall Square? I mean, if we talk about networks, then we need to a standard whether we're gonna crisscross from lines or we're gonna put one center points and then connect that to every dangling end of a street that runs into the square or I think that needs to be a little bit standardized, otherwise we'll end up with a hugely varying data sets. And the more connected a data set is, the more hard for some algorithms to actually use it, because the more loops and redundancy it contains, it actually drives some algorithms crazy if it's just overly complex. The other quality that would be amazing is the step question, level change. And that also probably requires a standard, like what do we start considering a step? Is it 1 inch or 2 inches or 5 inches and so on, but a sort of point feature on the network for every step would be I think very useful, but the standard still needs to be worked out, because if it's a staircase versus a ledge, do we put every step as a dot or do we use one dot to say that it's 10 steps, etc. So it's not easy to maybe like do it, but it would be super interesting to maybe pilot on a very small area, a couple of city blocks, and try to do it and see what's the trade-off of accuracy versus scalability, and figure out a standard that works across a larger scale. And then finally, the attribute data would probably be almost independent of the network. You could later populate it, but questions of width is critical for just to be able to accommodate a certain flow of people, quality attributes that others could perhaps fill in and survey of, like, what is the, is it a paving stones? Is it a dirt path? Is it a grass path?
We have that. Interestingly enough, I just got a data request for sidewalk width from somebody at MIT that's doing a study down there.
Mm.
And we're also doing 3D, which pardon me, Paul knows. But, you know, it's like we're trying to always get our terrain, you know, refined to the...
Yeah,
to the
elevation was really interesting, too.
Most, drilled down, so
yeah.
1-inch steps might be a little bit harder.
Yeah.
Well, another piece of this that I think is you kind of mentioned is the fact that a lot of the data that we have is about the past. But a lot of what's really important is what's in the pipeline. So when you're trying to design in a city that's growing very quickly, it's really good not only to have up-to-the-minute data, but information about what's in the pipeline. And I think that's a really interesting frontier, since it kind of gets to the political problems of information in the planning process and how that gets released to the public, at what time, and what forms it does.
Yeah.
But I think it's going to be an interesting challenge to make this really
in some ways, I mean, along those lines, what I think would be extremely interesting too is that during a public debate about an important plan, for instance, when you have a waterfront district in Boston, or North Cambridge, and North Point development, are there some metrics that we could publicly disclose to the general public about how a certain project performs? So, for instance, the TfL in London publishes the sort of, it's been doing it for 25 years or something, the, I guess they call it PTALS, Public Transit Access, Accessibility Lines or something like that. And essentially, from every place in the city, there's a very standardized metric that shows from that place, your accessibility to public transit is X. That directly affects how much housing that site can have, how much parking that site must have, and so on and so on. So I've always thought that it would be really interesting if, on a planning level, when we're doing especially large-scale planning, at least a block or so at a time, that we could apply a certain metric, like, for instance, what is the access to address points? Like, that's a metric that would describe how many address points can you walk to within 5 minutes in that development. And then if we have a standard that we know that on average in Cambridge, it will reach about 50 address points in 5 minutes, and this development says 4, then we're kind of seeing that something is really off. This building must be really big, or roads must be really inaccessible to cross, or something is off there. But I wonder if there would be some just almost like barometers or like temperature indicators of that are very simple, just because they need to be simple if they are scalable, but that we can apply on every public project that happens to describe some meaningful accessibility characteristic of those projects.
Like FAR or some other.
Exactly, yeah, something of that sort. But yeah, that would describe a human experience of the place rather than the density. Mm. Yes, Justin.
Thanks for the talk. I was curious, you've applied the tool and worked in settings where the government or the planning department has different degrees of involvement or authority in implementing plans.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any sense or thoughts about whether there's a relationship between sort of the degree of planning and the optimality of the accessibility networks in certain areas? Like, is there some sense where things that are unplanned sort of self an optimum accessibility network emerges using gravity as a, you know, whatever metric you want to use? So I'm curious
oh,
about
I see.
That.
Yeah.
The relationship between how optimal a network is and the degree of regulation and planning for that.
It's an interesting question. Depends on what optimality we're talking about or what performance metric we're talking about.
Like, take reach, for example, like in just the basic, like, is it the case that perhaps a city that has very minimal zoning or regulation, that things cluster and amenities cluster in a way that...
Well, certainly, for instance, like from the land use mix point of view, one example would be the sort of kampungs in Indonesia, the urban villages. Their land use mix, as we discovered, is incredibly complex and diverse, and much more so than the planned environments in Indonesian cities. And oftentimes, it's not a bad thing; it's maybe even a good thing, because the kind of, I mean, I'm of the opinion that land use codes are very often sort of legacy. The things that we try to keep apart don't necessarily need to be apart. And so you see very light kind of even production activities in kampungs that don't really produce fumes and smells for neighbors, and there's no neighbors really complaining. They may be packaging things or doing small works, and this in a planned environment would never happen in Indonesian cities. They would be enforced to separate them. But what I also discovered, I don't know if anybody's ever seen the Indonesian land use and zoning code, but it's an ingenious system. So they've adopted a Western style color coding for land uses, and there's I think about 24 categories of color. So we thought, oh, that's easy and clear. We understand how that works. But then, in addition to every color, there is a separate matrix that's something like 60 by 60 that says that if you're red, which might be commercial, you can still do this, and 60 different things in the red. And if you're yellow, residential, you can still have internet shop, a small, and essentially this matrix describes, I think, what really is there, and the color codes describe what they would like it to be, and they're overlapping in reality. So they can't sort of make the city illegal. It would just create an enormous backlog of negotiations in court if they did that. And so they've sort of adopted the system, but made it, customized it.
Cool. Okay, well, thanks again for presenting. That was excellent.
Thank you.